Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. First, again, I want to thank Ken and Gary and Rana for all their help on the internal medicine meeting this weekend, and also any of the residents that did show up. And I also want to congratulate the residents that went to the ACP meeting in Orlando. This morning, it's my pleasure to welcome Dr. Angelina Tay, who's a practicing hematologist-oncologist here at Boca Raton Regional. She went to University of Florida for college. She went to University of Miami for medical school, so she spread it around. University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where she did her internal medicine residency, and then University of Alabama, Birmingham, where she did her fellowship in hematology oncology. And she's going to give us a talk this morning on AML.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for having me here today. So my talk today is going to be just an overview of acute myeloid leukemia. It's going to be a pretty straightforward talk. I'm going to be reviewing what AML is, epidemiology, how we diagnose this condition, and how we consider treatment options in this patient population. So just a little bit of history with how AML was first described. In 1827, there was a French physician, Velpeau, who described a 63-year-old florist who developed an illness characterized by fever, weakness, urinary stones, and substantial enlargement of the liver and spleen. He described the blood of this patient as the consistency of gruel. In 1845, a UK pathologist, Bennett, coined the term leukocythemia to describe a series of patients who died of enlarged spleens and changes in the colors and consistencies of their blood. And then in 1856, the renowned German pathologist Rudolf Virchow coined the term leukemia. He was a pioneer in the use of light microscope and was actually the first to describe the abnormal excess of white blood cells in these patients. And about 11 years later, a bone marrow biopsy technique was developed. So this is a very simplified depiction of the lineage of cells that I'm going to be reviewing. In the bone marrow and in the cord blood, there are these hematopoietic stem cells. These are self-renewing stem cells which have the capacity to differentiate into further progenitor cells. In the blood cell line, these stem cells can differentiate into two main progenitors, the myeloid stem cell and the lymphoid stem cell. And then, respectively, these cell lines can then differentiate into more mature cells. In acute myeloid leukemia, it's the failure of differentiation which results in an accumulation of these immature myeloid blasts that we see here. So this is a depiction of how common this disease is. It's not a huge public health problem, but it is at least the ninth most commonly diagnosed cancer among men and women. And what's interesting is that it is a pretty deadly disease with almost as similar number of deaths per year as there are new cases. And that's in contrary to some of the other cancers that you see affecting men and women, for example, prostate cancer in men and breast cancer in women, where there's far more new cases diagnosed per year than there are deaths, whereas in leukemia, there's similar number of new cases and similar number of deaths per year. So acute myeloid leukemia basically accounts for 90% of all acute leukemias in adults. The remaining 10% comprises of other forms of acute leukemias, principally acute lymphocytic leukemia, or ALL, plasma cell leukemias, hairy cell leukemias. There's approximately 20,800 new cases per year. And this is generally a disease of older individuals. The median age of diagnosis is in the mid-60s. Unfortunately, the survival in patients with AML remains dismally poor. There's less than 50% five-year survival in those who are less than 45 years of age, and then less than 10% five-year survival in those who are greater than 60 years of age. So there are many potential causes and risk factors for AML. Many of these patients have antecedent hematologic conditions. For example, many of these patients have preceding MDS or myeloproliferative neoplasms. Some of these patients have had prior exposure to chemotherapy or radiation. Oftentimes, AML can develop decades after that exposure. Environmental exposures are also a known risk factor. Industrial chemical exposures, turpentine, benzene, cigarettes are a high source of benzene exposure for many patients. There's also, we recognize, a group of inherited conditions that can increase one's risk for AML. These are patients with unstable chromosomes, Down syndrome, Diamond-Blackfan, dyskeratosis congenita, and Fanconi's anemia. However, overwhelmingly, the majority of cases of AML are de novo cases. AML is basically a condition where there is marrow failure. So these are patients with either inadequate numbers or dysfunctional white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. So as one might expect, with dysfunctional or low white blood cells, you might see a greater incidence of infections. With low or dysfunctional red cells, you might see weakness, fatigue, dyspnea, palpitations. And with low platelets, you might see increased bruising and bleeding. So when the suspicion is high for acute leukemia, there are some points in terms of information gathering that are important to emphasize. It's important to obviously look at the patient's age, sex, ethnicity, but also to gather information regarding any antecedent hematologic issues. Have they had prior cytopenias or established hematologic conditions? If so, for how long? And have they been exposed to any chemotherapy agents in the past or prior radiation, immunotherapies, or toxic substances? And might there be some confounding factors? People who have had prior transfusions or growth factor support, certain medications are known to cause cytopenias, which can be confusing at times to know what the cause might be. Family history is also important to take into account. And then obviously consider any relevant physical exam findings and diagnostic study results. So here are some essential lab studies to consider obtaining when you have a patient where you're considering a diagnosis of AML. Obviously, the CBC with differential, and along with that, it's important to look at the smear under the microscope to see whether there's a predominance of some early blast cells. LDH, lactate dehydrogenase, is a sort of a nonspecific marker for cell turnover and can be very markedly elevated in patients with AML. COAGs are very important, not just because of future planning in terms of line placements, but it might help to differentiate a specific type of AML called APL, or acute promyelocytic leukemia, which is a type of leukemia that very oftentimes presents with DIC. Chemistries, uric acid, renal function, LFTs are all important to assess the patient's overall organ reserve, and also consider any potential prophylactic measures that you might undertake in terms of tumor lysis, prophylaxis, and things like that. If there are any neurological symptoms, lumbar puncture might be considered. And if this is a young, physically fit patient, HLA typing may be done if you're considering potential stem cell transplant in the future. So the ultimate gold standard in making a diagnosis of AML is by doing a bone marrow aspirate and biopsy. And the two main purposes of doing this procedure is to establish the blast lineage to see whether this is myeloid or lymphoid or some ambiguous form of acute leukemia, and also to perform a risk assessment from the information that we're able to garner from the bone marrow biopsy through cytogenetic and molecular studies. We can actually stratify these patients into favorable, intermediate, or poor risk categories. So a bone marrow biopsy is typically done with the patient in the prone or lateral decubitus position. It takes about 30 minutes to do. It is a procedure where we initially start by identifying the superior posterior iliac crest. And the way I was trained was to you could use four finger breadths above and over from the butt crack, or you could actually feel the anterior iliac crest and then kind of work your way towards the back. Another way to identify the posterior superior iliac crest is to look at some people have dimples, natural dimples on the lower back, and that's kind of where that falls. So once you identify that area, we usually prep the area with betadine. We then put sterile drapes on, and then we infuse with a 25-gauge needle subcutaneously with some lidocaine, and then go deeper with usually a 1.5-inch needle, although for larger sized people, you might need a spinal needle to reach all the way down to the cortical bone. And in order to make this as comfortable as possible for the patient, we usually infuse lidocaine into the cortex of the bone as well. So once you do that, we then make a small incision. We take a aspirate needle and put that through the incision and then all the way down to the cortical bone, bore it into the bone, and then extract about 5 cc's, about a test tube's worth of bone marrow aspirate, which looks really just like blood. And that part of the procedure can actually be quite painful for the patient. It usually lasts a few seconds, but I usually, will forewarn the patient that that part is coming. And then after that part, that needle is then exchanged for a larger needle called a Giamcini needle, which is basically a larger bore and you're able to extract an actual core sample, a solid piece, and send it off for analysis. Usually takes about 5 to 7 days to get all the results back. So from a bone marrow biopsy, we're really able to get a large amount of data. We're able to look at the morphology of the cells that reside in the bone marrow, but we're also able to do a technique called flow cytometry, which is basically, simply put, a cell sorter. It uses laser or impedance technology to sort through the different cells that reside in the bone marrow. And then we're also able to do cytogenetic and FISH analysis. FISH analysis basically allows us to look specifically for chromosomal translocations. And then in the right lower quadrant of the screen is molecular technology that we now have. We're able to really look at all the different molecular aberrations within the leukemia cells, and this really helps us prognostically determine how these patients might do. The World Health Organization basically sets the criteria for a diagnosis of AML as having 20% myeloid blasts in the bone marrow or peripheral blood smear. So once you've made a diagnosis of AML, it's important to, or even before you make the diagnosis of AML, it's important to stabilize the patient. Some patients with AML have very slow-moving phenotypes where they've had long-term cytopenias and they don't seem to be changing rapidly. On the other end of the spectrum, however, you can have a group of patients with very highly proliferative forms of AML. Sometimes in these cases, they can present with DIC. They can be bleeding on presentation. And it's important to provide those patients with transfusional support as needed. There's a specific condition known as leukostasis, which I'll spend some time on in just a little bit, where these patients can present with very, very elevated white blood cells, and that can present a whole host of different problems. Oftentimes, it's important, if this is a patient where you're considering intensive treatment, to establish a line, oftentimes a central line, to assess heart function as the tenet of the backbone of chemotherapy for these patients consists of an anthracycline. So we oftentimes consider getting a baseline echocardiogram. In preparation for potential tumor lysis, we like to start these patients on alkalinized fluids, oftentimes also with allopurinol, and be ready to use respiracase as needed. For someone who may not be as physically fit and who may not be a candidate for very intensive modes of therapy, it's also important to take a step back and discuss, you know, here what the goals of care are, whether it's curative or really mainly palliative. So hyperleukocytosis is a specific complication of acute myeloid leukemia. It's one of considered an oncologic emergency, one of the few oncologic emergencies. It occurs in about 5% of AML patients. And these are patients who present with exceedingly high blast counts, oftentimes over 100,000. The organs that are particularly susceptible to hyperleukocytosis are the brain, the lungs, and genitourinary systems. And these patients can sometimes present with intracranial hemorrhage, altered mentation, stupor, priapism, and there's early mortality in patients with AML who present with this specific condition. So how do these complications arise in patients with hyperleukocytosis? Well, it's twofold. So on one hand, in people with AML, you have these very large, inflexible blast cells. And unlike, for example, red blood cells with very flexible membranes, you get these very large white blood cells that end up clogging the small vasculature. So you can get a lack of perfusion to specific organs. But in addition to that, the blast cells can also attach to the endothelial membrane. And when that happens, it results in an activation of endothelial cells, and therefore it morphs these endothelial cells into sort of a more procoagulant state. So people can develop a greater risk of blood clots and you know, potentially bleeding as well. So here are some images for a patient who might have leukocytosis with evidence for pulmonary infiltrates and intracerebral bleed. When you see a patient like this, it's important to consider leukapheresis. And this is a procedure that rapidly removes excess leukocytes by mechanical separation. It almost looks like a dialysis machine where patient's blood is removed and the blast cells are mechanically extricated and the blood is placed back into the patient. A single round of leukapheresis can reduce the white blood cell count by about 10 to 70%. There is some debate as to whether leukapheresis does change outcomes. The argument is that the majority of the leukemia burden is within the bone marrow, not in the periphery. And in studies, the clinical benefit couldn't be consistently demonstrated. We still consider leukapheresis nonetheless in patients as a temporizing measure. Oftentimes it can take days to establish a diagnosis of acute myeloid leukemia. And so this can be a very useful, potentially life-saving technique for people who do present with leukostasis symptoms. So deciding on the best treatment options for patients with AML is actually fairly complex. And we have to take into account multiple factors. There are the clinical factors, patient's performance status, cognitive function, support mechanisms, and then the cytogenetic and molecular factors that we also take into consideration. So there's always a gut feeling, you know, when we're seeing patients in the office or in the hospital. And for someone like this, for example, the easy gut feeling would be to say, this is not someone who's a candidate for intensive treatments where mortality rates can be as high as 20%, and that's just the mortality rate associated with the treatment itself. This is an easy, you know, patient where this is someone you might want to be very aggressive on, but then there are some patients where it can be very hard to decipher what the best treatment is. For example, Ed Whitlock, who set a record for running a sub-4-hour marathon at age 85. But interestingly, he did pass away from prostate cancer within a year of this picture being taken. So then there are some adverse prognostic factors that we have to take into account. For example, anyone with CNS involvement with leukemia tend to have a more aggressive course. People oftentimes can present with systemic infections, and so it can be very difficult to determine the best timing of treatment. Is it better to wait till the infection is resolved or to start treatment right away? And sometimes that decision can be complicated. People with very high white blood cell counts, as I mentioned, tend to do less well. People who have secondary forms of AML tend to have more complex cytogenetic and molecular aberrations that make them more resistant to treatments. And I promise when I gave this talk, I wouldn't put up a slide with a bunch of mutations, but it's impossible really to give a talk without at least covering some of the basics. We know that there are some cytogenetic and molecular aberrations that allow us to stratify patients into specific prognostic categories. I didn't put up the slide for you to memorize it, but just to understand that there are ways in which we can really categorize these patients into specific prognostic groups. And this is sort of a survival curve of patients with different cytogenetic aberrations. The best performing AML patients are those with acute promyelocytic leukemia, although they have very dramatic presentations, oftentimes with DIC. If you can get them through that initial period, oftentimes they can do quite well. On the other end of the spectrum, you have patients with very complex cytogenetic aberrations, P53 mutations that tend to do much worse. There's also this new concept of categorizing cytogenetically normal AML patients into favorable and unfavorable risk groups. Historically speaking, people with normal cytogenetic AML were felt to have intermediate risk prognosis. However, now with our molecular technology and next generation sequencing, we're able to really parse these patients into more specific categories. I just wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about acute promyelocytic leukemia. This is a very unique form of AML, not very common, but this is a type of leukemia that results from a translocation of genetic material from chromosome 17 and 15. And there are some variant translocations as well that have been described. But what happens is that you get a juxtaposition of genetic material from the promyelocytic leukemia portion of chromosome 15 with the so-called rah-rah portion of chromosome 17. This accounts for about 10% of all AML cases, and it tends to occur, unlike general AML, which can oftentimes occur at much older ages, APL tends to affect a more wider spectrum of age groups. Again, as I've mentioned, these patients can oftentimes have very dramatic presentations, presenting with DIC, with bleeding, with blood clotting, and there are very unique therapeutic considerations that go into treating this form of acute leukemia, including the use of ATRA, which is a vitamin, essentially, retinoic acid, helps to differentiate these promyelocytic blasts into more mature cells, and arsenic trioxide. So the treatment for AML is based on a number of different factors. It depends on the disease itself. It depends on the host, and taking into consideration what the comorbidities are, what their physical status and cognitive function is, whether there's polypharmacy, how physically fit these patients are, and then also not to be ignored is the patient's own wishes. You know, what are their goals in life? In the older age group, quality of life becomes a more and more important goal of care, and their support group, whether they have a caregiver, family close by, these are all important considerations to think about, particularly when you remember back to that initial slide that I had showing that these patients with AML oftentimes don't have very good outcomes in the long term. When you have a physically fit patient, we're oftentimes focused on treating with curative intent. When we're treating with curative intent, the treatment is broken down into specific schedules. Typically, we start with what's called an induction program, which is a very intensive form of chemotherapy where the goal is to eradicate as many leukemia cells as possible. Oftentimes we'll do a day 14 and a day 30 bone marrow biopsy to assess how well the patient is responding to the treatment. If complete remission has been confirmed, complete remission being defined by less than 5% blasts in the bone marrow, then oftentimes we consider what's called consolidation, which is potentially more chemotherapy to eradicate any residual cells that might be remaining. If we don't do consolidation, approximately 80% of patients who go through induction and are able to achieve a complete remission end up relapsing. So it's very important to consider the addition of further chemotherapy in order to maximize the chances of cure in these patients. I won't get into too much detail, but this is just sort of an overview of what we call the 7+3 regimen. Again, this is really just for patients who are physically fit enough to receive this form of therapy. So the 7+3 regimen refers to 7 days of continuous infusion cytarabine plus 3 days of some form of anthracycline, typically daunorubicin or idarubicin. This is, again, generally reserved for patients with intermediate to favorable prognosis and low risk of treatment-related mortality. The anthracycline that's used in these cases typically is daunorubicin at a dose of 60 or 90 milligrams per meter squared, or idarubicin at 12 milligrams per meter squared, despite the different forms of anthracycline and the different doses, they all pretty much have shown similar rates of complete remission and survival. There are certain mutations that potentially may predict poor response to treatment, and they may benefit from higher doses. The standard dose of cytarabine is 100 to 200 milligrams per meter squared, administered as a continuous infusion over 7 days. Again, the dosing between low and high doses are pretty similar in terms of outcomes. The higher doses may have greater responses, but at the risk of greater toxicity. There's also another alternative regimen, FLAG-IDA, which consists of fludarabine, ARA-C, growth factor support, and then an anthracycline called idarubicin, which may be a reasonable alternative to 7+3 with similar complete response rates and overall survival. As I mentioned, if you achieve complete remission with induction, a large majority of these people without further treatment will go on to relapse. And that's why we will incorporate what's called consolidation treatment. The purpose is to eradicate any residual disease and to prevent relapse. For people who might have cytogenetically favorable disease, the standard approach is to consider 2 to 4 rounds of cytarabine, high-dose cytarabine. For those with more at-risk AML, higher-risk AML, we oftentimes will consider stem cell transplant in these patients. When considering these options, the risk of treatment-related mortality has to be weighed against the risk of treatment failure or relapse. Again, summarizing for consolidation, typically it consists of 2 to 4 cycles. Or stem cell transplant for that really high-risk patient. So when the intent is for cure and you have someone with poor risk cytogenetics or molecular aberrations, there's particularly high risk of relapse. These patients tend to have a very poor chance of achieving a cure, oftentimes less than 15%. So when considering patients for stem cell transplant, this is a pretty intensive form of treatment. Again, patients have to go through a rigorous pre-screening process. A donor has to be identified. Oftentimes, they're in the hospital for a month, and then they have to stay at the facility where they underwent their transplant for 2 to 3 months afterwards. So we have to consider the patient's fitness level, the availability of a donor, potential alternative options, including clinical trials, and transplant center experience. There's also several different types of donors that are considered for stem cell transplant. We always look first to a potential HLA-matched sibling. Due to the size of families these days, the chances of finding an HLA-matched sibling is less than 50% in most cases. So there is a National Bone Marrow Registry where there are potential other donors that might serve as a match. It's particularly hard for minority patients, people who are African American, Hispanic, or Asian, to find appropriate donors on the National Bone Marrow Registry, just because there tends to be more genetic intermixing. There's also the potential for HLA mismatched unrelated donors. However, when you consider these mismatched donors, there's a greater risk for graft versus host disease and the complications associated with that. There's techniques now available to perform transplants using haploidentical donors, for example, a parent or a child serving as a donor. In recent years, there's also a growing interest in using cord blood. This is a tremendous potential source of stem cells, particularly for the pediatric population, but because of the low volume of stem cells that you might find in cord blood, it's hard to use these in adults. Oftentimes you're having to use multiple samples together in order to get enough stem cells for performing an adult transplant. Since the population here in South Florida is mainly elderly, and this is the population that we tend to see often, I just wanted to spend a little bit of time talking about this group of patients. The overall prognosis in the elderly population is highly unsatisfactory. The definition of elderly is highly variable. You know, in some literature, it defines elderly as over 55 years of age, which here seems quite young. And there's really a diverse biology among patients who are quote-unquote elderly. Unfortunately, people who are considered elderly tend to present with more higher-risk disease. Oftentimes, these are patients who may have had antecedent hematologic conditions such as MDS or myeloproliferative neoplasms. They tend to have more abnormal cytogenetic burden of disease. They are less likely to respond to chemotherapy and are more susceptible to treatment-related toxicities. So when deciding upon the best treatment for the elderly patient, you have to consider, once again, how they function in life. And we, you know, tend to consider more aggressive treatment in elderly patients for those with good performance status, preserved organ function, de novo AML, those AMLs with more favorable to intermediate risk prognostic markers. For people who really have marginal performance status, secondary forms of AML, or adverse prognostic variables, we really look more towards less intensive or palliative forms of treatment. And there are lower intensity options for patients who are older. These are typically not curative options, but potentially palliative options, which can potentially reduce the transfusional needs or potentially improve survival. And there are cases where remission can be achieved by using lower intensity options. We just don't know how to identify who those patients are going to be. And these options include hypomethylating therapy. These are treatments you may have heard of Vidaza or Dacogen. Low-dose subcutaneous ARA-C can be considered clinical trials. This is an area of intense research. This is an area of unmet need, as they say, elderly patients with AML where the treatment options are not very good. And then the other option, of course, to consider is best supportive care, transfusional support, antibiotics as needed, but really the focus is on quality of life here. So for the past 40 years, 7+3 was the standard backbone of treatment for people with AML. But 2017 was actually a very exciting year for AML, and that was the year that we saw four new drugs approved for this condition. So in August of last year, a drug called midostaurin was approved. It's a what's called a FLT3 inhibitor. FLT3 mutations are mutations that tend to confer more poorer prognosis, and this is a potential treatment that might help to combat that that poor risk aspect. There's also a sort of liposomal version of the old treatment of 7+3, CPX-351, which goes by Vyxeos. this was also approved last year for a particularly poor prognostic set of patients, people who are older, who have treatment-related AML. And this liposomal form of treatment is associated with less toxicities, potentially. Interestingly, copper is used to stabilize this formula, and so it might be problematic in people who have, for example, Wilson's disease, who might be more susceptible to copper overload. Enasidenib was also approved last year for patients with a specific prognostic marker called IDH2. And then gemtuzumab, ozogamicin, was also reapproved. It was actually approved initially in 2000, but then taken off the market in 2010 because of safety concerns, but then reapproved by the FDA in 2017, given in lower doses for people with CD33 positive AML. In addition to those newer treatments, there's also a number of studies that are being done looking at newer therapies. One of the breakthroughs in treatment for cancer is many of you may have heard of, is a new form of therapy called CAR T therapy. And that basically stands for chimeric receptor therapy. And it's basically just a way of synthesizing T cell receptors that have antibody-specific capacity. So we're able to design T cell receptors that are aimed at specific predetermined antigens. And this is a type of therapy that's already taking off for multiple myeloma. It's already FDA approved for pediatric acute lymphoblastic leukemia, and it's also being heavily studied in multiple myeloma. So hopefully this is on the horizon soon. So just to conclude, AML is generally a disease of older individuals. It is biologically and clinically very heterogeneous. Cytogenetic and molecular aberrations can definitely stratify AML patients into favorable, intermediate, or poor risk groups. The standard treatment, which has been the standard treatment for 40 years, consists of 7+3. But in 2017, there were a number of new agents that were FDA approved and now can be incorporated with 7+3 or separate from 7+3 as single agents. Hematopoietic stem cell transplant is still strongly considered for the appropriate candidate. The treatment of elderly patients remains a significant challenge, and this is an area where there's ongoing clinical research, a lot of new drugs being studied. And CAR T therapy is a particular treatment strategy that I think we're going to hear about a lot more in the future. We're already seeing it approved for highly refractory forms of leukemias and lymphomas, and it's really gaining a lot more traction in people with AML. So that ends my talk. I'd be happy to answer any questions. All right, thank you.